In this episode, I am joined by Sabine Bann, a psychiatrist who combines her experience with patients, her work at Cambridge University and at her company Sciomics to improve our way of diagnosing and treating patients with mental illness from depression to schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. Together, we discuss the relevance of omics to provide much-needed physical diagnosis for these conditions and the impact of metabolomics in the field. Listen in on this episode, and don't forget to connect on LinkedIn to continue the conversation that we started today with Sabine Bann. Welcome back to The Metabolomist for a third season, where we will dive into the concrete applications of metabolomics and where this tool will impact society in the next 5 to 10 years. I am your host, Alice Limoncielle, and this year I am joined by a diverse group of scientists, medical doctors and other professionals who have used metabolomics and pushed it beyond just descriptive studies and towards applications that will or are already impacting people's lives. This year, the keyword is really impact. Like you, I know the potential of metabolomics. In the last two seasons, I've discussed with many metabolomists about how powerful, sensitive, and informative metabolomics can be. But this year, I want to zoom in on the impact, the applications that are or soon will be changing our lives for the better. Welcome to The Metabolomist. Today, my guest is Sabine Bann. Hello.
Hello.
You're a practicing psychiatrist and a professor of neurotechnology at the University of Cambridge in the UK. You're also affiliated to the Erasmus Medical Center in Rotterdam, where you're a professor of translational neuropsychiatry. And your work focuses on the molecular basis of neuropsychiatric diseases. You've also founded a number of companies related to that field, the latest of which is called Sciomics, that you co-founded with Dan Carroll in 2015. And the goals of Sciomics are to improve the identification and diagnosis of mental health issues. And so together with you today, I want to discuss what you hope to achieve with this company and also the use that you make of omics in your work related to mental health diseases. For our listeners, can you explain why it's relevant to use molecular tools to study mental health disorders? Why did you choose this approach?
The problem of psychiatric conditions is that we haven't really changed the way we diagnose them over the last 100 years since they were first identified or described by Emil Krepelin. So we're still using questions, asking patients about symptoms. We ask them about family history, and then we try to sort of come up with the diagnosis. This is done using structured clinical interview sometimes, but most of the time there is not a particular structure to it. It's based on DSM-5 or ICD-10 diagnostic criteria, which are only vaguely applied. And then a very experienced psychiatrist will be very good at diagnosing. Someone who's less experienced will be less good at diagnosing these conditions. So there's a lot of variability, which is a big problem. Because if you don't diagnose someone with the right condition, you probably treat them with the wrong drugs, and this is when they're not getting better. So there's a big clinical need to both improve the treatment, but also the diagnosis of psychiatric conditions. Diagnosing them early, we know, is improving the outcome. And this is really has been the focus of my work over the last 30 years.
Yes, and we will see this when we discuss the paper later, but I saw, for example, in this paper that the questionnaire that the participants took had, is it right? It had several hundred questions in it. It was a really, really exhaustive questionnaire that I guess they took the time to answer because it was COVID time probably, so they had a bit more time in their hands. But I guess that alone must be very difficult when you're undergoing depression to take the time to sit down and answer this kind of questionnaires, besides the difficulty of making a quantitative assessment of the answers. Just taking the test must be a trial.
It is difficult, but it's very, very important. And the big problem is that when people first present with psychiatric symptoms, they usually go to their GP. And the GP has on average 5 to 7 minutes. So they are not very likely to make the correct diagnosis. It takes on average 5 years for a GP to accurately diagnose depression, and for bipolar disorder, 7 to 12 years, because you need to have this extensive discussion with the patient to elicit all the symptoms. So it takes me as a psychiatrist on average one and a half hours. And here the patient will have to also answer these questions because this is the basis of these assessments. And this is where we come to the question, how can a blood test help? Obviously, if a blood test helps, and then the assessment can be much shorter because it gives you information, or maybe a standalone test, that would be great. It's probably not possible at the moment. This is the sort of based on our data over the last 30 years. We probably need to still do some form of assessment, but we can combine it with important clinical information. And with biomarkers, we may be able to come to an earlier, more accurate, in particular, more accurate diagnosis of psychiatric conditions, in particular, severe mental disorders, which is depression and bipolar disorder. These two conditions have a very strong genetic component. Depression in itself, probably more difficult. There are some attempts, and anxiety disorder and other conditions in the anxiety spectrum may be more difficult to diagnose because there's a lot of environmental factors. There's not so much genetic pathology that we know of, at least at the moment. I think the best chance we have to come up with diagnostic tests is in the field of schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, potentially depression. And these are called the major psychiatric conditions.
Okay, thank you. And besides the time it takes for the patients to get a diagnosis, also once they have this diagnosis, it must be a relief to know what's going on with them with this type of disorders. And do you think to have a kind of more physical way to diagnose these diseases, does this maybe also give the patient some sort of legitimacy to say, yes, I have a real disease, it's not all in my head, like in my thoughts?
Yeah, absolutely. That's the case. And that's what I hear from my patients. First of all, it's a big relief to at last get a diagnosis. When you feel your mood has been different, you may have been suffering from mood fluctuations, from low mood, from unusual thoughts, and suddenly you understand yourself. And that is a very, very typically big relief. And to have a biological basis, like someone who has diabetes, where they can measure it as well, puts it in the realm of real life and not just something which people perceive is going on in their head, because many patients think, well, I just have to pull myself together. And sometimes their environment is also pushing them. Just they don't understand what is going on in this person. They just feel it should be under their control to be different or to improve their symptoms. And this is obviously not the case. So yes, I think biological markers are also giving us an insight into the pathology, because although we have been able to diagnose and describe these conditions, it's only over the last 50 years that we have started to treat them more effectively. Really, in the 50s, the first antipsychotic drugs were discovered by chance when people were looking at antituberculotic and other drugs on, and then they tested all of these drugs out and patients in psychiatric asylums as well. And then by chance, they found that some of these drugs helped to relieve psychiatric symptoms. And the same kinds of drugs we are still using at the moment, we have improved them slightly, but not very substantially, because we still don't know what are the causes of these, the biological and molecular changes associated with psychiatric conditions. And therefore, we can't have very specific drugs. The most efficacious drugs are usually drugs which are not very specific, so we are calling them dirty drugs. They're working on many different neurotransmitter systems in the brain, and therefore they have also lots of side effects. But these are usually the drugs which are more effective.
Yeah. And so today we're going to talk specifically about the use of metabolomics in this field. You mentioned already the genetic predisposition, and I think all omics probably have something to offer, and because all the proteins, the metabolites and everything, they all work together to make the different mechanisms. But do you see a specific advantage to metabolomics? Why did you choose to look into this technique in particular?
When I started off looking at postmortem brains of various psychiatric disorders, schizophrenia, depression, bipolar disorder. And there I used a multi-omics approach. I used gene expression and affymetrix chips at the time. We used metabolomics and you used proteomics as well. And we soon found that we got more relevant, more consistent and reproducible findings using both metabolomics and proteomics. But at the time, and this was 20, 30 years ago, the metabolomics field had not advanced so that you had specific analytes. So you'd find a peak which was altered, but then it would take a year or two to find out what this peak was. So therefore, we focused on proteomics. But this has now obviously advanced, and particularly with your panel where they're clearly defined and annotated analytes, this has become much easier. So I think metabolites and proteins are obviously more closely related to a dysfunction. And we know that the genetics of these conditions only explain very little of the pathology. There is a strong genetic component, but even genome-wide genetic studies where they looked at tens of thousands of patients have not found a clear-cut genetic signature which would help to diagnose either schizophrenia or bipolar disorder, for example. So there are complex genetic abnormalities, probably also epigenetic, and then they present a predisposition. And then there are environmental factors, and we often see that life events, traumata, drug use can precipitate the first episode of illness. And these can be much easier tracked at the protein metabolite level as compared to the genetic predisposition, which is obviously something which is very static. And this is why I think these approaches hold particular strong potential.
Mm-hmm. And I think I did some research about the metabolomic profile of depression a couple of years ago. And I remember it's really one of these diseases where there's a lot of heterogeneity between patients. Like you have a lot of people with the same label in terms of diagnosis, but even if, let's say, they really have major depressive disorder and maybe not another mental illness, there's still a broad variety of presentation and of heterogeneity. And do you think metabolomics can also help with this? Because I've discussed previously on the podcast, for example, about asthma or about autism, people who hope that with metabolomics and who start to show with metabolomics that they can differentiate like subclasses within one disease. Do you look for this kind of things as well?
Yes, for sure. In particular, depression is a very heterogeneous presentation. Even some people have melancholic depression. People can't sleep at all. They can't concentrate. They have this sort of leaden paralysis. And some people sleep too much. They eat too much. They have symptomatically already very different presentation. And in between, there are all sorts of different subtypes, particularly for depression, to substratify patients on the basis of a molecular signature, which then may predict the response to certain drugs over others, would be very important. Because for all psychiatric conditions at the moment, the treatment is trial and error. So we treat with one drug and usually take several weeks for a drug to start to work. Then we increase the dose. We are then wait another couple of weeks. And then we may have to switch after 2-3 months. And this can go several times. So in the end, it may take up to a year, sometimes 2 years, until you find a drug or drug combination that is effective for a patient. So if we had any signature which would shorten the process to identify the right drug or drug combination in advance, that would obviously be tremendously important and reduce enormous suffering.
Yeah, absolutely. And maybe one last question before we discuss the paper together. But it's linked to the paper because in that publication, you used a group of subjects during the COVID time. It's an obvious question, but what has been the impact of COVID on the diseases you study? And can metabolomics bring you some additional insights about this?
For me, COVID started. I was not allowed to see my patients in person anymore, other than those who were very at risk of self-harm and who presented with very severe symptoms. But all other patients, from one day to the next, I had to treat online, either by telephone, and some of them online, but most of the time by telephone. And it was surprising how well it worked. And many patients recovered during the COVID period. And in the UK, it was very severe. So we were not able to leave the house for a long time. We were not allowed to go more than a few hundred meters around our house. I obviously, because I worked in the NHS, I was able to drive to see some of my patients. I was the only one on the road. But most of the time, it was on the telephone. And yeah, it was possible. I think the big quantum leap was that now there's also the possibility for patients intermittently. So I see them in person, and then they have also a choice that we talk online or we talk on the telephone in between appointments. It makes things easier. But here again, a blood test, you know, could have been done similar to the COVID test. And this is what we've done in our Delta study, which we will talk about. You can send a blood spot collection kit to the patient's home. It's identical or very similar to a COVID test. They poke themselves in the finger, they drop a blue blood spot, we send it to the laboratory, have it measured, and then they get the report. Obviously, we need to be a bit more careful here with delivering a diagnosis that is as severe as bipolar disorder, depression, or potentially schizophrenia over the phone. So I think it will not be possible to do this remotely, sort of in terms of explaining to someone what that means, what the treatment is. This can't be moved online. So there will also be the relationship with the doctor and the patient explaining. But in between, we can talk and catch up how things are going. But it obviously opens the door also for digital assessments, which we have developed also during that period, which is emulating a full psychiatric assessment. So the questions that I ask over 1.5 hours could also be delivered digitally. And then the patient, when they come to see me or to see the psychiatrist, one can focus on the things which are important to them. So I don't have to go through all the nitty-gritty of the questions, which I just need to know to come to the right diagnosis. Then one can talk about what is the treatment, how do they feel, and what do they feel should be addressed, what is their main concern. This opens up time and freedom to discuss and make it more patient-centric.
Thank you. So I think we're ready to discuss the paper. You've already given a bit of flavor of what this is about. So it's been published recently this year in 2024 in the Psychiatry Journal of the American Medical Association. And it's entitled Metabolomic Biomarker Signatures for Bipolar and Unipolar Depression. And Jakub Tomasik is the first author. So for people who want to find the paper, we will also put the link for the paper on the page of the podcast episode. So did I get it right that unipolar depression is what we would usually call depression, and then bipolar depression is more bipolar disorder, right?
Yeah.
Okay. You already mentioned it, and this was one of the aspects of the paper that I liked a lot, is that you use dried blood spots to look for these signatures. And I guess one aspect is that it's less invasive than a usual blood draw and people can do it at home. Is that the reason why you chose this way of collecting samples?
And there are several reasons for that. Firstly, one is cost. So my previous spin-out company, we looked at blood collected from the vein. So you have to draw the blood. You have to then very quickly process it in a cool chain. Then it needs to be shipped on dry ice. And by the time the sample is at a laboratory, it has cost already at least $600 or pounds or euros or something. They're all quite similar these days. Mm-hmm. So this is very costly. Whilst dried blood spots have been used for decades for newborn screen, every hospital has the setup. They use also little discs cut out of filter papers and do metabolomic analysis. And that is a really cheap test. They can be stored under desiccant environments for a long time. We've looked at dried blood spots, which are 40, 50 years old, in a collaboration with the Karolinska Institute. And even there, most of the proteins, the more abundant ones, are stable. The limitation of the dried blood spots, you can't look at the proteins which we previously looked, which are cytokines and molecules which are at low concentrations and also are typically less stable. But the advantage is we're looking at stable proteins in the dried blood spots, and therefore the platform is more consistent. Wow. That is the main reason. Cost. It's a stable platform, but we have stable proteins which are not sometimes present, sometimes absent. So we can develop algorithms which are more consistent over time.
The company, you use both proteomics and metabolomics?
Well, we started off with proteomics. That we had all our panel set up and developed ourselves 120 proteins with different peptides. And we did the study and we published that. And unfortunately, there was no signal with the proteomics. We were very disappointed. But basically, there was nothing. It did not add to the diagnostic assessment, which was the digital platform, which was in itself very sensitive and specific. It still much outperforms any biological signal if patients answer all the questions. But if they don't answer all the questions, then the, in particular, the metabolomic signature comes into play. So the metabolic signature that we identified in the paper had an area under the curve of 0.7, which is fair performance according to clinical evaluations. But if we add even few questions, we can push it very quickly to the 90% accuracy level. So we don't see this test being implicated clinically to patients who are happy, willing, and capable of answering all the questions. They don't need it. But those where the diagnosis is not clear and who are not able to answer this complicated question set, then this can be either standalone or in combination with the question with the digital biomarkers, because all the questions are markers, not biomarkers, but they are also markers of the disease.
Yes. And this signature that you have made up of 17 metabolites, it's a mixture of lipids and small molecules. And one lipid that we will talk about a bit in more detail probably towards the end is a ceramide, is the one that contributed the most to the signature. And you have an interesting combination of small molecules related to microbiome, so lots of metabolites of tryptophan, and then select lipids that contributed to this signature. Was that a surprise for you? Did it matter in any way for you to have this combination of small molecule and lipids? Did you have any expectations?
Well, I didn't have any expectations. You can't have really expectations with this approach. I think it makes a lot of sense. The tryptophan and the serotonin and dopamine and amines and neurotransmitters obviously play a role in mood disorder. So that wasn't surprising. The lipid changes, the sphingolipids, are also prominently present in myelin and in the brain. So this is also something which is very exciting. We previously had a Lancet paper where we showed myelin abnormalities in post-mortem brain of people with bipolar disorder. And also other people have found changes. And these changes have already been found in Alzheimer's disease and also multiple sclerosis. So there is the question, is there a similar pathological process? Is there also something where therapeutically we should put more focus on these lipid changes, which are present both in schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, also changes in glucoregulatory pathways.
Yeah, so these would be probably the most promising new, let's say, pathways to target with therapy. I'm a bit biased because I'm attending a lot of conferences about the microbiome at the moment. So if you haven't looked into it, I wouldn't be surprised. But are you interested in the potential applications of microbiome research for these diseases? Do you look into that? Or
we have collaborated with a group in Johns Hopkins University who treated schizophrenia patients with probiotics over an extended period. And then we looked at blood proteomic changes in that case. There were some, but it wasn't very significant. And it was not a significant difference between the control group and the patients. I think it is very interesting, but in this particular study, we didn't find something significant. At the moment, this is not what we are focusing on. So we are really focusing on the blood. We are focusing on the digital platform, and we are quite busy with that. And we are validating his findings at the moment. This is the focus of my lab. We are trying to validate them and then hope to implement them in clinical practice as well, if we can reproduce all the findings.
Yeah. So where do you see the impact of this research in the next 5-10 years? I guess this is the main place where you see applications.
Yes. So our digital platform, which, as you say, sort of has several hundred questions, but they are delivered non-linear. So I need to clarify, patients are not asked 1,700 questions, which is in the question bank. There are always some opening questions. Have you been low in mood or depressed? And if you say no, it will not ask you the next 300 questions about current or past symptoms. The same for bipolar disorder, substance use, or all the other symptoms that it will sort of check on. So the average time for someone who may suffer from anxiety disorder to do the assessment is half an hour. But if you have lots of symptoms and comorbidities, and this is very common in psychiatric conditions, it may take up to 1.5 hours. But the feedback from patients is they feel they are listened to, they feel they're asked appropriate questions, and this is also relevant to them. And they can take their own time. And what you said before, it's very exhausting if someone has to answer 1.5 hour or has to answer questions within an hour, 1.5 hour face-to-face assessment. Here they can take their time, they can breaks, they can come back to it, it is safe, they can do that over several days. And this is also for many patients an advantage to do that. So this is really the focus. And we are already in the NHS, our form is used in the NHS, and the biomarkers we're still developing and validating in the lab. But we have a idea and pathway how to bring it to the clinic. But at the moment, the focus is the digital assessment and then bring in the biomarker at the second stage. Mm-hmm. That may not be in the NHS, it may be more privately because it's big hurdles as well, sort of to for someone to pay for that when it's newly developed. Initially, private patients may be interested to do that, as you say, because they want to have a biological diagnosis. And whether we do it in the UK, we don't know. We need to see what the traction is.
Mm-hmm. Is this an advantage of creating a company like Sciomics to have this separation between the academic work and the more applied work? Does it help to do that through a company? Does it help you to go through some of the hurdles?
Oh, yes, of course. You know, I think it wouldn't be possible otherwise. And this is why I did it when I first spin out company, now with the current spin out company. It's a separate thing to do research, academic research, publications, or to bring a product to the clinic. It becomes repetitive as well, the research, because you need to optimize things. There's a lot of refinement going on that is not seen usually of great academic value, because here one discovers something, then tries to discover something new in a company. It's really optimizing a product. My academic lab, however, is also supporting and working very closely with the company to do that. And for me, this is important. It's more important than having very high impact papers, possibly, by focusing on a different field. We are trying to optimize the current platform. We're trying to optimize the current diagnostic platform. And this is incremental work, academically, probably less exciting for some.
It depends. I think this must give a particular type of value for your team also in the university, because there are lots of people who use metabolomics and find a signature or a set of biomarkers to discriminate between different groups, but then nothing happens of it. And I think it's really special when you're in a team where part of the team takes it to the next level. And even if you only partially contribute to it, to see that this is taken to the next step, I would expect this would really bring value to the work of the people who work with you.
Yes, but it's then not from bench to bedside. You know, this is what excites me, because I'm also the chief medical officer in the company, not only the founder. So I'm involved in all the details. If you develop something and you're not a doctor and you're not part of a spin-out company, then you give it away and then someone else is taking over, which is important as well. But for me personally, the preferred approach is that I sort of stay involved and I continue to bring in my vision into the product. You know, obviously there are other people and they bring the commercial aspects, but we're working very well together and it's quite exciting.
It is. Are there other things you would like to tell us about Sciomics?
We are currently trying to develop a product also that's not only used in the NHS, but where individuals who are worried about their mental health can do the assessment themselves. So it doesn't have to be delivered through a healthcare service. And I think this is sort of democratizing the assessment and the diagnosis as well, because many patients are maybe worried, a little bit anxious, a bit worried, or more so. And they don't want to talk to a doctor in the first instance. They want to know themselves, you know, if I do this assessment, what is the outcome? At the moment, there are lots of questionnaires online, but they're only for depression, for bipolar, for any given disorder, but not for all of them together. And then people looking for information may come to the wrong conclusion because of the overlapping symptoms. So I think it is important for people to be able to comprehensively assess their symptoms so that they're more likely to identify sort of the right diagnosis. Then they can see their GP, can ask for a referral, or they can choose to see someone privately, because there is a big need for psychiatric assessments. The need is not addressed. In the UK, it's particularly difficult, but other countries are struggling as well. Psychologically,
it's sort of like
it's also difficult, you know, it's a long waiting list. So if you have an idea, if you do the assessment yourself, there's a lot you can do to help yourself. And it was very interesting when we did the Delta study, which is part of what is also discussed in the paper. We also did a 6 and 12 month follow-up. And people who did the assessment therefore thought about how they felt, answered all the questions, and they got a very minimal report outlining just they may be suffering from a certain condition. We provided psychoeducation in the context of the condition that they are most likely have. And then at 6 and 12 months, we found that they have significantly improved. There was an improvement which was as significant as they had had psychotherapy for an extended period. And the feedback was that they felt, as a consequence of having a diagnosis or feeling understood, having thought about how their symptoms had developed, they'd talked more openly to their friends, they've also reached out for help, they changed their lifestyle, doing more activities, and therefore they felt better in themselves. So for milder symptoms in particular, this can be very, very helpful. For more severe conditions, and if someone realizes they have a more severe mental disorder, then they definitely should see a doctor urgent.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And I find it fascinating how this online questionnaire, because it is made the way that you made it, that it asks relevant questions and doesn't get lost in details that are not relevant to the specific patient, but also probably because it makes each person reflect on their own situation. The combination of those two things in itself is already support and is already probably helping people go a little bit further. So, but this in combination with, for example, a future diagnostic tool from Dried Blood Spot makes a kind of whole workflow to support people from beginning to get help to actually getting a diagnosis and hopefully a relevant therapy.
And what we found in the signature, and this is very preliminary and we can't publish it because we're underpowered at the moment for this specific aspect, but there is an indication that the biomarkers are normalizing in those individuals who are treated and whose symptoms have normalized. And that would be particularly interesting. If you could follow our patients, they do the assessment. They are currently, and usually the signature is meant for bipolar depression. They're in a depressive episode of the bipolar disorder. They're then treated, and then the signature is normalizing. And then they can do it, and they can see where they are. And it maybe also indicate a risk of relapse. So they may be able to reduce medications in an interim phase, and then when the biomarker signature is becoming more prominent again, they may want to increase the dose again to avoid relapse. And this is the problem with bipolar disorder. You have these highs and lows, and it's very important to catch a swing to either the up and the low early on, and you can flatten the severity of the symptoms.
Yeah. There's really a broad spectrum of application. So I think when you have a signature that is a good fit for the specific disease you look at, then you can really apply it to many different things, not only to diagnosis.
Yeah.
It's really fascinating. Thank you very much. I would be ready to go on to our last question about your favorite metabolite. Have you given this some thought?
Yes, definitely. You mentioned it already. Ceramide is really a very prominent biomarker to distinguish unipolar and bipolar depression. It makes up 50% of the signature, so it's a very strong signal. And it's a very specific ceramide. It's not just one which is in all the creams and body lotions. It's also linked to the brain in the form of sphingolipids, myelination, and it's thought-provoking, to look now for drugs which may already exist which are modifying the presence at a concentration of this metabolite, whether these could be already some drugs available which we could test as add-on medications for bipolar disorder, particularly in those patients where this metabolite is very high. Does this indicate a demyelination process? Could, for example, multiple sclerosis drugs help? Here, I think this sparks a lot of interest, and hopefully others will look at that, because we will not be able to do all of this. But hopefully people will read that, other people in the field who are more on the therapeutic side and have ideas about novel drugs that are needed very badly as well.
I think findings like this, especially with ceramides, are coming at a good time now, because the discussion about lipids and the importance of lipids in signaling and in mechanisms that are relevant to health. And ceramides are really one of these lipid classes that is kind of on top of the list of everybody's interest. So I was looking a bit before we started discussing, like, have there been other findings of ceramides in the context that you look at it? And indeed, there are other groups also who stumble onto either this one or other ceramides, or the family as a whole that is being changed. And this really opens the door for some interesting findings in terms of therapies and how to modulate this mechanism or to salvage these mechanisms so that the ceramides or their precursors or are less affected and more stable, perhaps. Thank you. This was a very interesting choice. I thank you very much for taking part in this podcast. It was lovely to discuss with you. I had a really good time. I learned a lot about mental disorder and the use of molecular tools to study it. And I really look forward to seeing how those findings that you made develop and whether we'll get some much improved ways to diagnose and treat and support people with mental disorders.
Thank you very much, Alice. I also want to thank and acknowledge my funding body, who's been supporting me over 25 years. This is the Stanley Medical Research Institute, and particularly Professor Fulatori. They have been dedicated, and all of our goals have always been to bring something to the clinic, and we hope that we can make the life of patients better with these inventions.
Fingers crossed. Wishing you all the best.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to The Metabolomist. I hope that this episode got you excited about the upcoming applications of metabolomics and that it motivated you to support science that brings a positive impact to our lives. To make sure you never miss an episode, register to our newsletter on the podcast webpage, themetabolomist.com. To learn more about metabolomics and how to plan your own projects, check out my book on metabolomic data interpretation at biocrates.com/thestoryprinciple. And don't forget to connect with me, Anice Limoussiel, on LinkedIn to continue the conversation on the many ways that metabolomics impacts health, research, and our lives.